gentlemen, welcome to the Masters.
Welcome to the Talking Golf Podcast with me, Hugh Marr. To continue our Masters Week shows, we're very lucky to be joined by putting coach Phil Kenyon. Phil is one of the leading coaches in the game with a client list that includes Rory McIlroy, Henrik Stenson, Justin Rose and Tommy Fleetwood. Welcome, Phil. Thank you for taking the time to join us. Phil, let's start by finding out a little more about your journey as a coach and how you have gone from playing the game through PGA Professional to, I think, a degree in psychology, and now the go-to putting guy for the majority of the finest players on the planet.
I'm not quite sure how I've ended up here, really. So, I'd never intended to end up doing what I'm doing. My journey into golf, really. I mean, I sort of was introduced to the game by my parents when I was about 11. And fairly early on in my golf career, I got pretty friendly with one of my dad's friends, who was a guy called Harold Swash. So very early on, I was around Harold, spending a lot of time with him, playing golf with him. And, you know, Harold was a sort of prominent putting instructor at the time. So I've kind of always been around putting and coaching and stuff. I was obviously at that age just loving playing the game and had aspirations to be a playing professional. I got down to sort of like plus figures at 18, and I'd been lucky enough to play sort of like for England schoolboys, and had aspirations to play. But I also kind of valued the importance of education. I think like my parents had always instilled that in me, and I went to university to study applied psychology and sports science, which I really enjoyed. And then I enjoyed it so much that I stayed on and did a master's degree in it. And it was at this time I was really undecided whether I was going to turn pro or actually stay on within that field.
And you were still playing competitive amateur golf throughout your university career in the UK?
I went to Liverpool John Moores University, which was close to home, so for me, there was a couple of benefits. I mean, firstly, the course, it was one of the better institutes for sports science. But secondly, I could stay at home. It meant that I could really concentrate on my golf, keep me off the booze and all the other student activities. I played a lot of golf, you know, all the amateur events, British Amateur, Brabazon, stuff like that. You know, all that I could do around my studies. So at the end of that, once I'd sort of graduated from completing my master's, I was really at a crossroads to sort of utilise my, you know, qualifications or do a turn pro. And I turned professional at that time to play on, you know, like the mini tour stuff. I think at the time we had a satellite tour in the UK called Mastercard.
Yeah, that's right. I think it turned into the Euro Tour, wasn't it? That was the sort of forerunner of the Euro Tour.
Yeah. It did, yeah. So I remember my first MasterCard event very well. 36 holes in one day, I remember. So, yeah, I turned pro. I had aspirations to play. And I kind of set myself about like a five-year sort of timetable to where if I hadn't felt like I'd achieved anything, then I was going to sort of move on.
And how many of those 5 years did you see through?
Yeah, I actually played sort of for 6 years, really. But in that fifth year, I kind of knew that I wasn't really progressing as a player. And it was at that time I joined the PGA, and I actually started sort of teaching under the PGA.
And you were teaching
banner.
For or with Harold at this time, or was
yeah,
that?
Yeah, well,
that,
I,
was that later
kind
on?
Of, once I sort of turned pro and I was playing, I needed some way of earning money, so I had various jobs. And, one of those was I would help Harold out on certain trips or activities, certain clinics.
Yeah.
I kind of started as sort of like his cameraman in many ways. So I'd help him, you know, do his thing. So at the time, you know, I was doing it to earn money. It was obviously of interest and I enjoyed sort of being around Harold. But then, I had access to obviously, a pretty good coach, and I was learning all the time without realizing it. But it was only really until I decided I was going to pack in playing that I appreciated, I had an opportunity there. And it was at a time when Harold was sort of really slowing down and he was, why don't you come on on board and that helped me properly. So, like I say, in that fifth to sixth year, I started sort of focusing more on coaching. I was doing my PGA at Hillside, doing some full swing coaching, and then, you know, getting more involved with Harold and developing that side.
And how much, I mean, obviously you've gone on a pretty significant journey yourself over the last, I guess it must be nearly 20 years now. How much of Harold's philosophies, belief systems do you still employ on a day-to-day basis?
Well, you know, Harold, I think if you look at Harold's, the core principles of his teaching, then I still employ those. I mean, Harold really came from an engineering perspective. And, you know, when I look back, he was kind of talking about ball flight laws for putting, you know, 30 years ago. And, you know, I think he was ahead of his time in many ways, because it was only really when technology started to improve and high-speed cameras, the application of those within sort of put a fitting, etc., that many people appreciated some of the things that Harold had been talking about. So his basic principles, I would say, you know, are still a cornerstone of my teaching. But obviously, I think, you know, my own experiences as a coach and I think in particular my education have kind of shaped my approach slightly differently. And, you know, if Harold was here today, God bless him, we'd have this conversation, and Harold was definitely a little bit more of a, he had a more of a method, I think, than what I would have. And he was quite a stickler for his pupils doing things in certain ways, where I think my approach is being a little bit more flexible, but, you know, a lot of the same principles in what we're trying to achieve still there.
It strikes me, one of the things that, I mean, I've worked with you with various players individually and with players in national squads, and one of the things that's always struck me about how you coach is that you're very good at combining the science, the data, the information, the facts with the artistic, less scientific side of coaching. And in a sort of, I guess one of the challenges in this day and age is that there's an awful lot of people with an awful lot of information, and they're in one camp, and then you've got the other camp, which are the guys who might not have the information, but they're incredibly good at communicating it.
Yeah.
Is that something you've consciously worked on, or is that something that is just, is that your gift?
I don't think it's a gift, because, you know, you're not born with that, are you? I mean, it's something that you acquire. I wouldn't say it's something that I consciously worked on either, but I've been asked that kind of question before, and I think if you look at my experience or how it's been shaped, I mean, I think when you play golf yourself and you've even aspired to be a tournament professional, you understand, you know, the difficulties and complexities of that improvement pathway that everyone goes on, you know, and the perils of it. And I know in particular, you know, at times I was probably over technical and sought too much advice and got myself confused at times. So there's kind of like some personal experience from playing the game. I also think like my studies have helped me, you know, in particular the masters that I did was looking at motor learning and control, and obviously specifically I was looking at golf. So, you know, looking at contemporary theories of learning and stuff like that have definitely helped me further. And then, you know, like your day-to-day coaching shapes you, doesn't it, in terms of
all make the mistakes. Biggest influence.
So, yeah, you know, how many lessons you give where you've been too technical and or confused the people. So I would say like a combination of all those experiences have shaped the way that I teach. I mean, I take that as a compliment coming from you that you say that. I mean, it's not necessarily something that you're aware of, but I do understand, particularly when it comes to putting, that, you know, there is very much an artistic side of it, particularly when it comes to performance when you're out on the golf course. You know, you really want to be free from technical thought, but at the same time, you need a fundamentally sound technique so you can execute the skills.
Yeah, you need sound mechanics to fall back on, regardless of what's going on from an intellectual or psychological perspective.
Yeah, and so you need to be in a position where you can manage them. So,
knowing what you know now, would you have approached your playing career very differently, and could it have had any impact on what you're doing now?
Well, I'd go back and I think I would do things very differently, yeah, for sure. I'm glad I did what I did because, you know, I got out at a great time for me. You know, I had enough of a taste of it to learn, and I couldn't think of doing anything more enjoyable than what I do now. So if I'd have stayed in, if I'd have been more successful and stayed in professional golf for longer, you know, would you know, I could be in a very different position. I might not even be in the game now. So you know, so but I would, if I went back, I, knowing what I know now, I would do things very differently. Yeah.
Would I do anything different? Yeah, of course, I'd have done a, I'd have done a bundle of things different. Would it have any impact? Nah, I think I'd probably still be doing what I'm doing now. I might have come to it later on, but I think I'd still be doing exactly what I'm doing now.
Yeah, I guess the unknown thing is that, okay, it might have, you could go back, do things differently, have more success. It delays the, you know, the deterioration of your career, you know, professionally, playing-wise, and do you then miss other opportunities? I mean, certain things, you know, I've been very lucky. I've had opportunities that are presented to me at times. You've obviously got to grasp them, but if I'd have gone down another route, you know, would those opportunities have presented themselves? So, but yeah, I mean, for me, you know, I don't think I was, well, I know that I wasn't good enough, and you know, I believe that there's, you know, talent is a very tangible thing, and you obviously need that, you need some degree of talent in line with hard work and, you know, and all the other things, but I was severely lacking in the talent bit, regardless of how hard I worked.
And I think that talent debate is maybe not something for today, but I'd love at some point to be able to discuss that more, because, I mean, we've talked about it a lot, that ultimately I'm a firm believer that talent does exist. Can't believe that for one moment, if you do the right things for 10,000 hours, you'll end up being an expert if you're not starting with some talent in the first place. But as I said, we'll leave that for another day. It's Masters week. You've got five players in the field, six players in the field. Is that right?
I've got a couple more players in the field.
Oh, of course you have. So I wanted to, basically, we want to try and give the listeners out there some behind-the-scenes access to what it's like at Augusta National during the week of the tournament. Let's start by looking at the challenge itself. Is it all hype, or is the challenge that much different to your average PGA Tour or European Tour event?
I would say it is very much different, yeah, the challenge. It's a unique golf course, so it represents a very different challenge than what the guys would play, you know, play each week. So I wouldn't say it's hype. I'd say, yeah, it's a very different sort of thing that they face.
And just, I mean, just the environment as a coach is different in that you're not allowed to walk inside the rope during practice. So you can do all this good work on the putting green, but as soon as they go out and play a practice round, you have to, if you are out with them, you have to watch them outside the ropes. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, you're not allowed out on the course at all during the week. You're actually not allowed on the practice facilities unless you're invited by a player, and the player can only have one coach. Or one person with them at that time. So you literally have to stand with the public, and when your player is ready, they'll invite you over. One of the green jackets will come get you, and you'll go and do your work. So it's a very different, which I actually think works well, because
I think it's great from a spectator's perspective.
It's great from a spectator's point of view, because the putting green and the driving range, spectators can see what's going on. It's not cluttered and crowded like you see in many, you know, many events. So they've got their own way of doing it. It's a great week to be part of. So you kind of just suck it up and do what you need to do. You're not allowed out on the course. And the ironic thing is, of all the tournaments, you probably would want to spend the most time out on the golf course that week as a coach.
Yeah.
Particularly for me, because the unique challenge of Augusta are the greens. But unfortunately, we're not being able to get out there on the course, and it makes it a little bit more difficult.
I remember years ago, Dennis Pugh, when he was coaching Monty, I think he ended up putting the boiler suit on and caddying for nine holes to get inside the ropes during practice. Are you prepared to do that?
I would do. Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
Did they do one in your side?
No, but I could borrow one of the kids' ones from the par three contest.
I just unroll the trouser legs up.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I mean, the difficulty with that is obviously the time that with having a few different guys playing, so you've got to obviously try and allocate your time. I mean, the one thing that I have done a few times, which has really been really beneficial, is to actually go with one of the players, or go with various players to Augusta prior to the tournament.
Yeah.
That, you know, they can bring someone with them. So rather than a caddy kind of going, I've gone with the player, and that's allowed us to spend spend time on the greens, preparing accordingly, and that's massively beneficial to be able to have that time with them and get out on the course and look at the pin positions and stuff like that. So
how different is the course when you go for these kind of recce trips beforehand? Is it very different to the week of the tournament?
It can be. So I was actually over there on Monday, and I was surprised how firm and quick the greens were. You know, they almost felt like tournament speed. Where I was there the week before as well, and they were very, very slow. There was a lot of grass all over the place. You know, the fairway's quite long. The greens were sort of quite slow, but they recently had their Jamboree, which is like their major members tournament, I think just a few days prior. So they were probably trying to de-stress the course because they normally get it up to tournament condition for that.
You are listening to the Talking Golf Podcast, and this week, Hugh's in conversation with specialist putting coach Phil Kenyon. To find out more about Phil and the work his putting school do, visit haroldswashputting.co.uk or find him on Twitter by searching @swashputting. If you're enjoying this show and want to hear our next episode, make sure you hit subscribe in your podcast directory.
But Monday, I went with Henrik, and the greens were really quick, and it was fairly realistic to what, you know, like a tournament speed could be.
It must be fabulous to walk around there with no fans, actually see the golf course properly close up.
It's very different to the tournament week. The place looks totally different. It's quite open when you kind of walk through the clubhouse and come out by the first tee in the putting green. There's this sort of big expanse from the just right as you look of the 18th, and you can see down towards like the second green beyond the first fairway. Yeah. It's very, very different. It's a different, it's a very sort of tranquil, very different vibe. And it's just, as a golf fan, it's just nice to be able to actually walk on those fairways, walk on those greens, and, you know, like remember certain shots that you saw as a kid or certain putt. And, you know, it's a privilege, really, more than anything. It would be an appropriate word, privilege.
It's a special place, and it's so difficult trying to explain to anyone who's never been exactly how fabulous it is. It's just such a mind-blowing place. Absolutely love it. So, talk me through typical day, week on tour, and it's obviously going to be a little bit different at Augusta because the sort of limitations on you. But what does Monday through Wednesday look like for you?
At a regular tour event.
At a regular event.
Well, sort of Monday. Monday would normally sort of travel into the venue, so that could involve a flight. Sometimes you might get there early on a Monday if some of the guys, you know, if there's not been a tournament the week before, there's been a bit of a break, you know, some of the players could be there on a Monday, so you'd travel early to catch up with some of those. I would say predominantly Monday would be a travel day. Tuesday typically would be up early, you know, could be breakfast around about 6:30, bit of the golf course for sort of 7:30. And I think everyone's different in how they sort of go about their work, but I'd try and like schedule players I work with to times, so I would the day before I would try and arrange with the different players who I know are going to be playing to meet at specific times and just catch up with them on the putting green. You know, a lot of time at events, it's kind of like supervised practice. It's not like you're giving a player a lesson every week, but you're just, you know, making sure that their practice is efficient, they're doing the right things. And you're there to help and keep an eye on them in many ways, and problems solve if required. Obviously, some weeks, depending on where the player is, you know, there could be like more technical work done, and other weeks it could be just trying to help them prepare to perform. And then obviously, you know, with some players, you'll be out on the golf course. So for me, those days are pretty busy. Very often, you know, you won't get a chance to sit down or have lunch, and you could be, you know, still there 7:30 at night. So it'd be back to the digs, quick shower, something to eat, and bed, really. I mean, you know yourself, Hugh, it's not rock and roll, is it?
The best piece of advice I was given was the minute you start doing this for a living, get used to eating when you get the chance to eat, because you've got no idea when you'll get the next opportunity, and sit down whenever you can, because you could be out here for 12 hours quite easily.
Yeah, I mean, the day goes quick, that's for sure. And, you know, at times when it can be the opposite, where you're at an event and you haven't got so many players, and or you've got some gaps, then it's actually, I find it boring. So yeah, you've been busy, but yeah, it can be long days. And then Wednesday, you know, it's same again, really. Wednesday predominantly is pro-am day, so you might see guys for a sort of shorter sessions on the practice green, but then you've obviously got pro-am, so you could be out on the course with those as well. And then the difficulty is just trying to make sure you see everybody and allocate your time prior to Thursday. And if I'm, you know, the certain tournaments I will just attend sort of practice days, but then there are, you know, some tournaments I'll stay through the tournament, and you're there for warm up, warm down. Try and catch some golf out on the course when you can. So again, the tournament days can be long, because you could have a guy who's first off at, you know, 6:45, and someone else who's last off at 2:30. So you're there for warm up, and you're there for them for when they come off the course in the afternoon. So tournaments can be long, or tournament days can be long, but you know, it's good fun at the same time.
Yeah, it's not a proper job. It really isn't.
So you touched a little bit on pre and post round routines. What would that involve? I know you're very big on getting players to calibrate properly, get set properly at the start of the day. What else does the warm up entail?
Well, I think, you know, everyone's slightly different, aren't they? And I mean, on a personal level with players, I like sort of daily calibration in terms of just like the basic relative to them. You know, what are the kind of key performance indicators relative to each player technically? So you're just kind of recalibrating what those feels are on a daily basis, really. But you know, your warm up is about getting mentally ready as much as physically ready for putting. I mean, a warm up in a full swing is obviously going to be a little bit different, isn't it? But really, just making, you know, getting a feel for your stroke on that day, and then really, you know, going through your routine, getting a feel for the speed of the greens, and getting into your mental processes, really getting your mind ready, so that when you're on the first hole and you've got a real smelly 5 foot down the hill, left or right putt, you're engaged. You know, you've already gone through your mental routine, your processes. So it feels like the fifth hole and not the first hole.
Personally, I think that's something that players tend to neglect more than coaches, the importance of getting themselves mentally in a place where they're ready to perform in the warm-up. It's not just about loosening the muscles or feeling the ball in the club face, albeit that's part of it. It's, are you ready to walk to the first tee, or in your case, walk to the first green and ready to go? You say you're engaged, you're into it, you're ready to you know what it's going to take to hit the right shot.
Yeah.
So post-round, what's different?
Well, you know, I think, again, you're there really just to help the players reflect. You know, if you've been lucky enough the way you can get out there and watch some of the action, or you know, you'd be able to see some of it on TV, then you can help the player reflect. You know, if they have if they're not putted well, you can talk through what's happening. And quite often, obviously, the players are very attached, aren't they, emotionally to that performance.
Yes, absolutely.
And sometimes the judgment can be clouded, so you just try and really give them some objective feedback, and then problem solve, really. You know, what was it that broke down, and helped put those pieces back together? Or even sometimes just there as a sounding board. So it's really just being ready for the player. You know, if they put it well, often, you know, it's just a slight warm down, recalibration of those feels again. I think during the tournament, you know, practice really, trying to keep that same tournament focus. So I like certain performance drills. If a player's going to come and practice in between rounds, then not just spending loads of time on technique, but, you know, doing performance drills to keep that focus and intensity.
So changing tack a little bit, in Monday's show, we talked to Paul Casey a little bit about, obviously, the challenge that Augusta, that Augusta presents. And we kind of came to the conclusion that putting is probably not as significant a skill Augusta week than it is other weeks. Is that something you'd agree with, or is that something that you'd argue?
I think, I mean, if you look at sort of a lot of the stats, I think hitting, correct me if I'm wrong here, but greens in regulation, I believe, is a really important stat, isn't it?
Yeah.
At Augusta.
Round here, yeah. And it seems to me there's been a sort of catalogue of winners who are renowned to be ordinary putters, let's say. And particularly in the modern era, as the greens have got firmer and faster, while the slopes may not have changed physically, the surfaces mean they play very differently. It puts much more of an onus on being able to ensure that you don't have as you say, a smelly five-footer five or six times around, the guys that are able to roll it stone dead and tap it in are probably going to gain shots in the field.
Interesting. I mean, who would you categorise as an ordinary putter that's won that event in modern day times?
Adam Scott, Bubba Watson, Sergio.
Yeah, statistically.
All very good drivers of the ball.
What were the putting stats that week?
Question, which I had a funny feeling you'd ask me. I suspect they putted. I mean, I think Sergio last year didn't three putt a week.
Which is an achievement in itself, isn't it? To not have a three
putt. Incredible round there.
I didn't know that. Did he not three putt all week?
I'm pretty sure that's the case.
I mean,
the ordinary putters that overperform or that putt significantly better end up winning.
Yeah, the thing is, I mean, we're lucky, aren't we? Particularly in our role with like stats that we have available now, so. You can, you know, with ShotLink and all the other data available, you know what, you know, that an average winner will gain on the greens. You know what is required approach play. And you can then even tailor that to venues and stuff like that. So you kind of can develop like the makeup of a champion on any course or any tournament,
yes.
Can't you? Now, with Augusta, we don't really have all of that data to hand.
Correct. True. I think they gather the data, but then they don't release it.
Yeah, they gather the data. They have their own ShotLink system, but it's not released. So we don't really have the strokes gained data on the greens and stuff. You, when you're on site, you have access to that data because I know myself, I'll go in and I'll look at that data during the round to see how players are performing during the round and post-round, and then we'll look at that data, you know, upon sort of like the, you know, post-round reflection. So they have strokes gained tee to green, strokes gained approach play, strokes gained putting. So internally they do that, but they don't publish it. So unless you're during that week, you know, keeping an eye on what the winner's doing, it's hard to get a feel. But I think you'd be foolish to undervalue how important putting is there, because it's extremely difficult. You've got to put well to perform average statistically. Okay, you're not going to hole loads of putt, but then if you consider what putting badly would be on a lesser course, you're going to get eaten up at Augusta.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, you're going to be unlikely to play 72 holes.
So it would be interesting to look at the baseline of what strokes gain would be at Augusta that week. And I think like the if you look at the challenge of Augusta, if you look at like an average pin position on the PGA Tour, it's probably around about like one on a 1.5% slope. You go to Augusta, then the average pin position is on a 2.5% slope. So the greens are
quicker and firmer. And
exactly. You know, you could be prepping all week at 12 on the stimp, and then come Thursday when they've got, you know, 12 hours of sub air overnight, you've got 14 and you've got a win. It's very difficult because the visuals that you're not used to, a lot of the players aren't used to those visuals. You know, the amount of break that you've then got to play when you're 14 on the stimp on, you know, a bigger slope than average. It's being able to tap into that visual. So the greens are challenging. Because they're difficult, it probably, to a certain degree, I think statisticians would probably then say it makes it more even for certain, you know, because it's quite hard to, you know, perform well. It possibly takes some of the skill away, you would argue, because it's so difficult. Like, if it was so easy, it would take some of the skill away, wouldn't it?
Yeah, correct.
So you could argue it takes some of the skill away, but I think you've still got to put well on those greens to win. There's been great putting performance over, I mean, Danny Willett, when he won, like, he putted fantastic that week. And there's a lot of different, you know, many different ways to skin a cat, you know, aren't there?
Yeah. So, the one thing that strikes me is that the guys who are able to move it, I mean, it's almost cliched now about Augusta that you've got to be able to move it right to left to play well. I'm not sure that's the case. You certainly need to be able to move it right to left at will. But I do think you need to drive it very well to have a chance of finishing high up in that field, because your ability to then put the ball in the right part of the green to make the next shot significantly easier. Over 72 holes, that's got to give you a better chance.
You've got to have a good all-round game, really, haven't
you?
But there probably is more of an emphasis on, you know, a really good tee to green game than if you were playing in the Spanish Open or some other course, you know, it might be less penal. You know, when you miss the greens at Augusta, you can, you know, you short side yourself. It can be very, very difficult to even make a bogey. So there is a premium, I think, on, you know, good, accurate iron play where you're leaving yourself in a position to make the easiest par or even give yourself a birdie.
Yeah,
so obviously, you know, there's a premium on the long game, but you've also got to be able to convert those chances, and you could three putt in a heartbeat there, so you basically need
from any range.
From any range, yeah. Mm-hmm. So you need your all round game, really.
Yeah. Well,
Phil, I think we've taken more than enough of your time this evening. I know you're very busy in preparation for the event. Before you go, though, we've got to ask you, giving our erstwhile listeners one simple piece of advice that you think would help benefit their game.
Find a coach that you can develop a long-term relationship with.
Brilliant. Doing your best to advertise the skills of PGA Pro. I like that.
Yeah, might not be a PGA Pro, but find a coach that you can develop a long-term relationship. Someone that you can that can mentor you, someone that can be there for you and help develop your game. I think that's the most important thing. You can't do it on your own.
And, no, you can't.
Phil, thanks very much for your time. I always enjoy chatting with you, and best wishes to you and your players this week. I hope that at some point in the future we can get you back on the show to continue
our
discussions.
Yeah, we'd love to. Yeah, thanks for inviting me onto the pod. And good luck with it, Hugh.
Thank you, Phil. I really appreciate that.
Success with it.
Fantastic.
Cheers,
Many
Hugh.
Thanks.
Okay.
You've been listening to the Talking Golf podcast. This week, our guest was Phil Kenyon, specialist putting coach to many of the best players in the world. To find out more about Phil and the work his putting school do, visit haroldswashputting.co.uk. This show was presented by Hugh Marr and produced by Matt Gore of Vicon Business Media. You can connect with us or comment on the show via Instagram, Talking Golf Podcast, or Twitter at Hugh Marr. And if you've enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, make sure you hit subscribe in your podcast directory.